Welcome to Patients at Risk, a discussion of the dangers that patients face when physicians are replaced with non-physician practitioners. I'm your host, Dr. Rebecca Bernard, and thanks so much for joining me for part two of my three-part discussion with nurse practitioner John Canyon. John wrote a report criticizing the state of nurse practitioner education and outlining solutions. You can find the details to that entire report in the show notes. So, John, your goal is to try to hold these schools accountable and responsible to ensure that their graduates are actually prepared to take care of patients.
Yeah. And I mean, not even just that initially, but now I want them to be better. I want them to come out and be better than me. I want them to be better. Each generation needs to be better than the last. We need to be smarter. We need to have more knowledge. We need to be better trained. We need to take our lessons from prior generations. Nobody's actually critically looked at NP education. I mean, there's not been one study that has been critical of our education to be able to say, are we doing a good job? By the standards by which we're measuring, then yeah, if people are passing boards at a high rate, that means you're doing a good job. Well, is that the appropriate measure of success? I don't know. I mean, our number of lawsuits are going up. The amount of payouts are going up. Is that because we're not training enough? Is it because there's more NPs? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But what I can tell you is the people who are coming out are not getting hired. They are, companies and employers are preferentially looking for experienced nurse practitioners over new grads. They don't want to hire new grads because they know they'll have to train them, at least the larger corporations. They don't want to do that. They want somebody who can come in and work and do the job. And if you come in and it takes you a year or two to get up to speed, that's a massive loss for the company. To me, I should be able to walk into the job and do the job from the day. That's what I was trained to do. And when I got out, when I walked my first day on the job, I had to work. And fortunately, I spent a lot of it because the ER that I was going into, I had worked at before, and I knew I was going to have a job there when I was done. So I spent 750 hours training in the ER, which was just the ER in my family program. So when I got out, I'd be able to do the job. So day one, I could do the job. Was I great? No. Could I get by? Yeah. Did I ask on every patient? Not every patient. Most patients for the first 3 to 6 months. Yeah. It took me about 9 months to get comfortable working. And then, you know, and when I had questions, I would ask. When it's time to punt, you would punt, you know, and it just takes time. If I didn't have that additional time that I spent in the ER getting ready to work it, then I would have never had a chance at being successful.
You know, you talk about how it's getting harder for these graduates because there are expectations. And so what I'm seeing now is this trend of entrepreneurship and a lot of people that are trying to help nurse practitioners hang a shingle, as if you call it that. For example, the elite nurse practitioner has, you know, a whole bunch of videos trying to encourage NPs to do all sorts of things that I consider quite outlandish, IV infusions and ketamine and just everything that you could possibly imagine. And the other thing is a big influx into mental health, because that's still an area that's hiring. I'm very worried about that, especially with what you're telling me. What are your thoughts about this trend?
I don't know much about the hanging your own shingle and all that. I don't know. I've seen the same things you've seen. I don't know enough about it to be able to speak intelligently on it. I don't think the training's enough. And I don't think it's where it needs to be by any stretch of the imagination. Here's my question. And this is my question anytime I talk to one of my academic friends. When you go and you see a nurse practitioner, would you be comfortable with them being from any program in the country, not knowing their background at all? That's my question. Because if the answer is no, then that means we're not doing what we need to be doing. And my answer right now is no. I'm not comfortable with that. There's some that I'm comfortable seeing. Yeah, some that I know that are pretty good. But the question is, are they succeeding because of their training or in spite of their training? To me, it seems like it's in spite of instead of because. And it's a concern, man. I mean, because yeah. I'm getting old.
That all the time is like, I'm speaking as a doctor, but really I'm speaking as a patient, because one day I will be the one looking up from that gurney. And I'd like to know that the person taking care of me has the basic understanding and skills to be able to do that.
the ACEP, American College Emergency Physicians, says there should be an ER doc in every ER in the country, right? Covering every ER in the country. The problem is it's not realistic. There's too many ERs. There's not enough ER docs. So we can help cover some of that. But who do you want? Do you want somebody who's just fresh out of school with 500 hours? I don't.
No.
I don't absolutely either. I want somebody who's not going to make the mistake like they did on my dad. I had two make a mistake on my dad in the same 24-hour period. And my dad ended up in trauma ICU afterwards because they missed. The radiologist missed on the CT read too, but that's not the point. The point is they missed because they didn't know. He had over 65, had a fall and had multiple broken ribs, went to the urgent care. They said, you have multiple broken ribs and it looks like you're developing a pneumonia. And you know, that's a pulmonary contusion. So old man, multiple broken ribs, pulmonary contusion, that's a trauma admission, 100%. Over three, it's 8% increased mortality per broken rib. It's just, and then he called me and I'm sitting in ER next to my ER attending and the trauma surgeon. And I'm like, you need to go to the ER. You need to be admitted. And you need to be admitted, need to be admitted, need to be admitted. And he goes to the ER, they do a CT of his chest, multiple broken ribs, pulmonary contusion, send him home. You're not hypoxic. You don't need to be admitted. No, that's not how that works. And of course, I was super busy that night. I didn't get the chance to call him back. I said, call me. You need to be admitted. You'll be admitted. They'll admit you. This is any ER in the country, they should admit you. They didn't. Send him home. And then he's like, oh, I'm doing fine. I'm being okay. I'm like, well, I'm really pissed about this. And then 3 days later, his spleen rupture caught up to him and he ended up being life flighted to a trauma center. So I'm just... You know, and that's just another example of, yeah. And even if that hadn't happened to me, I see the mistakes coming into the ER all the time. The question is, we see this increase in med mal. We see the increase in payouts in med mal, but how many do we cover? How many do we cover that don't end up being med mal cases? I had a patient come in the other day who'd had a nail through the shoe in a diabetic and nail through the shoe, they need to be treated for Pseudomonas. They weren't treated for Pseudomonas. So you got a pseudomonal infection, lost half their foot, right? No med mal, no med mal case. This is a few years ago. No med mal case.
Does the patient not sue because the NP or PA or whomever was nice and listened to me and they tried their best?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's of course, you know as well as I do, that's the number one reason people don't sue is if you're nice to them. And yeah, I don't know. I'm okay with people not suing. It's not the point I'm trying to make.
But your point is you're using that as a marker for errors because we don't have a lot of ways to really calibrate that.
We can't measure it.
That's one that we can at least use as a surrogate marker of quality. And I think your point is so well taken that although we can brag on our website on the AANP of the number of NPs that are practicing, why is there no scrutiny of the practice? We have had a few articles, one by emergency nurse practitioners, academics that were really concerned about just the variability in emergency certification, and another by family nurse practitioner researchers also showing this paucity of, you know, people of skills. And yet there's been no systematic review of education and certainly no call for an overhaul. Now, other than working with the CCNE, have you had any conversations with any NP leaders, AANP, or anyone else?
I actually sat on the American Association of Nurse Practitioners Education Enhancement and Sustainment Committee. They called me and asked me to sit on the committee, so I did. Part of that was signing a non-disclosure agreement. So I can't speak of anything that occurred, right? And during those meetings or anything like that. And that also kept me out of this space for a little while, but I wanted to try to fix our problem from the inside. And I think that that's a good way to do it. But the problem is, one of the problems is they say there's when I talk to my academic friends, is there's no literature that says there's any problems, right? There's no literature. If there's no literature, then we can't take any action.
Just pretend that everything's okay.
Well, you know, if the whole academic world is based on the literature, right? So if the literature says one thing, that's what we're going to believe, even though the nurse practitioner journals state that they won't publish anything that's anti-FPA or puts us in a bad light, right? So when I write something like this, which by God, it's not a great paper. I get that. I haven't written anything academic in 25 years, right? So I get that. The quality's not great, whatever. It's fine. Get that. But the point of the paper, the gist is the issue, right? is somebody you need to, we need to look at our education and say, we have holes, we have problems, we need to fix the problems. And if you go to publish something like that, and the journal's like, well, we're not interested because you said that you don't think we need independent practice.
So there's no literature, but on the other hand, if there were literature, it wouldn't necessarily get published. And right. Further, how come the academics aren't actually looking at, you know, we have had independent practice out West for what, 20, maybe 30
long
years?
Time. Yep.
So how come there are no randomized controlled trials or evaluating care provided by unsupervised,
it would make sense,
non-physicians?
It should make sense.
There should be something at this point if anyone were interested in looking at that data.
That would make sense. And it would, there's states like I practice in Arizona. There's states where you can practice. Arizona's independent practice. You can do that study. You could do that study and you could argue to a IRB that it's valid based on the state laws, right?
Yeah.
You can make that argument and do the study, but they're not done. And I don't know why the answer to that is. I don't know if there's a fear or if they just be based off of, and when you look at the studies they're flawed. Most of the studies are highly that I've seen are flawed and just have all kinds of problems. There was one that came out, two or three years ago, that was out of emergency medicine, which showed similar outcomes between ER docs and NPs and PAs. But the problem is, what kind of supervision do they have? What kind of, like, I've worked in probably 40 plus ERs in my career. I do a lot of locums. So every place I go is different. Every amount of supervision at every place I go is different, even within the same state borders. So Texas is a supervised state, so we have to have a supervising physician on all of our cases. And in some cases in Texas, I work very independently and only talk to the doc when I need to, or when I need them to review a case. And then they have to review X number percentage of your charts, right? In some cases, in some ERs I work at, I bring every single patient to them like I'm a resident. So when you look at this study that was done a couple of years ago, there was no description of what the independence of the practice was. How independent? How often were you talking to the doc? Was I sitting next to you and going, hey, would you look at this toe? Man, I'm just not sure what's going on. And then I finish the chart, have a great outcome, but I've already consulted you. So does that count as independent? Not really, right? I mean, it's really not an independent deal. Now, I get most of what we do, there's interdependency between other areas of medicine in the ER. Like we consult people all the time, and that's okay, but those should be appropriate consults. Are we consulting appropriately, or consulting when we need to, when we don't need to? Are we dispositioning with the appropriate medications? Are we having similar throughput times? Are our procedures, risks, and our failures, our adverse events similar to our, that's not there. And then on top of that, how much of the supervision was there? How much of time did I actually spend? I don't know. And I looked at that and there was no description of it. So I can't really look at that, even though they say there's similar outcomes in their conclusion. I don't know how they got there. So you can't really draw that as an example. And it's actually one of the ones I wanted to use in my paper until I started looking at it. And I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. So our literature is kind of not great either way. And it's just, I mean, there's not been, like you said, a true randomized controlled study to actually look at this, and we could do it. We could. I really think our education as a whole just needs to be complete revamp. It just needs a complete revamp, because I don't think it's good enough. And I don't think there's enough clinical training. And I think that when we get done, you should know when you pick up the phone and look at my credentials, what my credentials mean. But right now you can't do that. If I didn't get the emergency cert, let's just say I still was in my family certification and I didn't get my bonus ER certification, and I have an FNP, and I come to you and I said, hey, I want to work in your ER. Well, can you? I mean, technically, yes. Technically, I can. Our scope of practice only involves three things: our population foci, so our age range or gender limitations. For instance, you have a women's health nurse practitioner, so that would limit what they can do. You have a pediatric nurse practitioner, which limits what they can do. You have an adult nurse practitioner, which limits what they can do. Then you have the family nurse practitioner, which is supposed to be across the lifespan. So if I'm going to work in an emergency department, if you ask many of my academic colleagues, they will say, well, you need an acute care nurse practitioner. Well, if I'm an acute care nurse practitioner, I can only see adults. Not very many ERs in the country where you can just see adults. So, right. And so you get in this weird confounding deal. And so my thought is we need to have just, it needs to be broken down into a base nurse practitioner and then specialized training on top of that. So that way, if I'm a credentialing committee, like for instance, if you're sitting in a credentialing committee meeting and you have a board certified ER physician residency trained, you know what they can do. If you have board certified nephrology, you know what they can do. You have board certified cardiology who has the appropriate procedures, you know what they can do, right? We're very similar conundrum wise to the PA, where the experience matters a lot. And I think that experience does matter. And if you have experience, and there was actually one study I referenced there that showed that there was a difference between PAs and NPs and docs in their outcomes and unnecessary referrals. The PAs and NPs had more unnecessary referrals and had poor outcomes, but the gap between the physicians and the NPs closed with experience. Didn't say they met, but it said they closed. And to me, that just harkened back to not enough training.
Right. So the 2019 closing ceremony of the AANP conference had a lecture by Margaret Fitzgerald, who I guess sells some of the testing review courses and things like that. And in her closing comments, she put up a photo of a smiley face with a zipper for the mouth. And it said, "Sometimes the strongest voice is silent." And she was telling the people, the attendees, that if you're opposed to full practice authority, you need to stay quiet. So I'm assuming that means that you are not super popular among the establishment, or even I wonder how your colleagues are approaching you with the way that you're speaking about your concerns.
There's a lot of people, a lot of nurse practitioners really, really do see the problems and are speaking out now and starting to become more vocal about the problem, but we can't get published on it. You can't publish the data. So it's not going to ever make it in the academic mainstream. Like, I mean, you know, I did this paper and 1,000 people have seen it, maybe 6,000, 7,000. There's 400,000 nurse practitioners. You know, I mean, you can't really sway minds if you can't get people to look at the issue. And, you know, one person just put, "That's too long. I didn't read it." You know, I mean, it's too long. Not going to read it, which is fine. I get it. People are busy. But when you're looking at a problem and you say, yeah, there's a problem, well, we've got to have a solution. You've got to have direction. You have to recognize that there's a problem. Then you have to identify the problem. Then you have to come up with a solution. And then you need to test your solution to see if it works. And if it works, then you implement your solution, right? So we have to go through this process. And my solution may not work. It may not be the right way to go. It may not be. I don't know. But until it gets tested, there's no way to know. My solution, 6,000 hours. Significantly more than the minimum of 500, right? And we actually fought to get the minimum number of hours increased to 2,000. And there was rumor that they were willing to do that. And when it came to brass tacks, they're not going to happen. No, they're trying. They're going to go up to 750, which is better than 500. But it's what, another.
Couple of weeks. Let's see. What is that?
Yeah. So 40 hours a week at most, 80, you know,
maybe a month.
Another month of training.
Right.
You know, month and a half, maybe.
Well, I like the ideas that you lay out in your proposed solutions, where not only, first of all, you say that we need to improve our admission requirements, because we know that there are a lot of NP programs that have 100% acceptance rate. So anybody that applies is getting in. So standards can be really quite lax. So you would suggest that, number one, they need to have really be screening candidates. They need to make sure that they're actually interviewing people, making sure that they're committed to the profession. You would want them to have had at least 2 years of nursing experience as well, just even before they started
minimum
NP school.
And in a critical care area. Because
right. So they need to know what sick looks like.
Yes. That's one of the most, I mean, when I came out of school, one of the reasons that NPs were at the time we were coveted above our PA counterparts because of our ability when we came out to recognize sick and not sick, because we could see, I could walk in the room and go, oh shit, something's wrong. Oh, I need some help. Need some help right now.
I think you're so right, because as a family doctor doing those months in inpatient and doing the ICU, I don't use any of that today, but I sure do use it when somebody walks in my room, in my exam room, and I know I better call 911 right now.
Yep. I walk in the room and I'm like, that's wrong. You got to go.
And that's not something you want to be hemming and hawing about. You need to recognize that immediately. I think in the case that we explore in the book, Patients at Risk, the case of Alexis Ochoa, just simply knowing that this patient looked sick, she would have been transferred. And instead of just sitting on her for 11 hours before actually doing well, her vitals were very unstable. But if you don't have that experience, although this nurse practitioner, although she did a family nurse practitioner, she actually had been an ER nurse. I don't know what she actually, how long she was, or, you know, what she actually did there. But I think you're right. Like, some critical experience would make a big difference.
Credentialing issue. That's a credentialing issue.
Oh, absolutely.
So get back to, let's say, for instance, I've been working with you in the ER for this. I use the ER because it's my best example, because it's what I know. So I've been working with you in the ER for 5, 6, 7 years. And you think I'm very, very good at what I do. Very comfortable. You're very comfortable with me taking care of patients, or not me, for instance, somebody else, say Joe Smith or Jane Smith. You're very comfortable with her. And she's an F&P. So then I apply because you need help. And I have the same credentials. So shouldn't I be able to do the same job? Right. And you see that's where you get into the conundrum of somebody getting hired out into a critical access area. Well, hey, they've got the same credentials as this person that we know and we love who does a good job. Obviously, with the same credentials, they should be able to do the same job.
And the reason it's not true is because the standards are so variable.
Well, it's not even that. The training. So one of the three, there's three areas of focus. We started on this: population focus, so your age ring, your training, right? So training is important. It doesn't have to be academic training though. So you can get postgraduate training, which like for me, from being family nurse practitioner going into the ER, postgraduate training. When I first came out, those guys spent every day, I had tent and alleys on my desk. I was reading a chapter a day, and then we'd go over. I had to see every single patient that came in the ER, and I had to see every single sick patient. I had to do every single procedure, and that's how they trained me. And so when you look at these, the population focus, education, and training, right? So have I been educated on ER? Yeah, I would say so after going through that. Yes. Have I had been training? Yes. But not every NP gets the same education and training. And that's why I think it's very, very important for patients, 100% for patients, and two, for credentialing committees, because the vast majority of credentialing committees in hospitals are all docs. And so they just look at the credentials, and the credential says FNP, they can do this, and that's, I understand that, because that's the world y'all come from, where if you're an internist, or if you're an intensivist, or a hospitalist, or an ER, or gastro, or whatever, then you understand what that means. But we're so vague, intentionally vague, in what we can do, so that way we could be pliable and be able to go in different areas and be able to work in that area, that we've become so nebulous in the description now that nobody knows what anybody can do.
Right.
Which makes it ridiculous. So you get, that's why I think you have to have additional training in a specific area. So I can come out, and I don't even think, be honest, I don't even think that 2000 as a generalist base is enough to go into one area and be a specialist there, even in family medicine. Because you know as well as I do, family medicine is its own specialty. You have to know it. If you don't, like, I couldn't go out and do family practice now. I don't know anything about SLGTs and all that. I don't know anything about that stuff.
Yeah, there's all new stuff. And also just taking an undifferentiated person off the street, and not just with one problem. That's what I love when I look at the literature. It's like, it always examines like diabetes. Like, well, that person has diabetes, high blood pressure, chest pain, depression, anxiety, and their toe hurts. You know, there's always a million things going on in primary care.
Yeah. And people don't realize that. I mean, it gets a bad rap because it's not a specialty, but it is. It's its own specialty, and people don't realize that. Yeah. And I think you need dedicated time to learn that specialty as well. And I think that we're at this precipice in nurse practitioners' professional growth as a profession, that it's time to go, hey, We need to take this change and we need to move. And one of the things that scope of practice was an issue. And so they tried to come up with this consensus model that was supposed to make it all better and to try and explain stuff. And there was a couple of things in there that made sense, like the old way of doing things where you have this base knowledge and then you triangle this pyramid and you could add extra knowledge on top. Makes sense, right? But the problem is there's so many of us now that it just doesn't make sense to continue down that path. We need to split and become specialized so that way we can prove our credentialing and prove to insurance panels and to credentials and to patients. So the patient knows what it is. I mean, nobody knows. I mean, I don't know. There's credentials out there I see behind a nurse practitioner's name, and I've been doing this 25 years. I have no idea what they are. Almost 25 years. It's been a long time. 20 years. But I don't even know what they are. I look at their post-nominal credentials and I just like, what the hell?
Yeah. No, it's really confusing. And I've tried to study the consensus model. You ask different people, you get different interpretations. There's alphabet soup. And so I think that you're speaking out and trying to put some pressure on leadership to really, you know, get back to what made nurse practitioner profession really great, which was, you know, having worked as a nurse and bringing that nursing approach and then really understanding and studying and getting a solid foundation. And then to me, working really closely with physicians, which you've done for so many years, and then still having access to a physician in the event that there's something that's not following the way that you would expect it to. And I think that more voices like you have to speak out and put pressure on your leadership, because I don't really see any motivation for them to change.
There's not. And one of the, I mean, I've had people call me and scream at me and be very upset with me when I put this paper out. And I mean, it's published on Substack and immediately got a whole bunch of reports for spam, which got it taken down, which is back up now. But it's things like that. Well, we got to shut it down. Well, how about you critically look at it and say, hey, let's have a discussion. Let's talk about it. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. But, you know, I'm not a betting man, but if somebody took the way that I want to do it and instituted it, I would guarantee that the students would come out significantly better than what they are now. And just not even a little bit. I think the difference would be so much that I think that you would have a network of people trying to come back and do this, because I think that it would just naturally grow instead of them trying to force things with like the DNP where they're trying to, you know, round peg square hole. And then you get people not opposing it and just not wanting to do it because it's not clinical and it doesn't give you any additional clinical training. And it's really not. And it really doesn't really do anything for you. So what's the benefit to it? It's not really showing any benefit. But if you have a situation where you're actually, if they have this, I would sign up tomorrow. I would sign up. Yes, 100%. I may not need it per se. Right. I've been doing this for 20 years, right? I've been in the ER 20 years. I may not need that, but I would do it tomorrow if nothing else than to show everybody else, I think this is the right thing to do. I think having this additional training and having the specialization and doing that is the right thing to do. And I think it would put us in a better position moving forward. And it'd make us better at taking care of patients, which is the bottom line for everybody.
That's what it's all about. Thanks for listening to part two of my three-part discussion with nurse practitioner John Canyon. Stay tuned for our final episode where we explore some of the pushback that John has gotten and some more of his recommended solutions for this problem. If you've enjoyed this podcast, I encourage you to get the books Patients at Risk and Imposter Doctors. They're available on Amazon and at barnesandnoble.com. And if you're a physician, please consider joining the group Physicians for Patient Protection. We are a group that is fighting to protect physician-led care for all patients and truth and transparency among healthcare practitioners. You can learn more at our website, physiciansforpatientprotection.org. And if you have any interest in appearing as a guest on the podcast, please send me an email through patientsatrisk.com. Thanks so much, and we'll see you on the next podcast.